to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and we're live in downtown Bloomington. Audience, we want to hear from you. Don't be shy about asking your questions about Epiphany Farms, Anjou Above, or what you enjoy at those locations. And also thanks to our first guests, who you just heard, Ken Mishka, also Nana Mishka and Stu Hummel with Epiphany Farms Enterprise. Thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having us.
You've come a long way, Ken. As we heard in Colleen's report, you're hitting goals in year seven that are in the 10-year business plan. Tell me about this plan. How is it different than a typical starting plan for what might be a typical restaurant group?
I think it's a lot different just because it encompasses the working and business of two different sectors. So the hospitality side of food and beverage, but then also the farming, production, and distribution side. And so that definitely makes things a little bit more challenging at times. For instance, when we're trying to tighten up a system at the restaurant, I'm just like, why can't we just get this figured out? And I'm like, oh, okay, it's because we're trying to build a farm at the exact same time. And so it's a completely different dynamic. But one thing I think definitely in the beginning, it was really just a three-year goal. And it was about how do we get a restaurant? And then we had a lot of dreams after that. And I think when we got close to the three-year goal, we started developing these long-term strategies. But at first, it was the naiveness in me that was like, oh, yeah, we can farm and raise all of our own food and open up a restaurant in Bloomington with very little as far as financial backing and experience.
And Stu, did you think you could farm and do a restaurant at the same time? Did you share that belief with Ken?
There was never any question that we were going to fail. No, it wasn't ever an option. It's like there was so much at stake.
What's the percentage of new restaurants that fail? I mean, it's astronomical, isn't it?
Yeah, we're not going to be part of the statistic. So whatever it takes, we're going to make it happen. That's always been the mindset.
What about the next 7 years? Where is Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group headed? We heard some of that in Colleen's report, but what can we expect? What is some of what we can expect here in Bloomington Normal? Nanam?
Well, we have lots of plans, more restaurants, expanding farms, and as you heard, like wineries. We have lots of big goals and have great team right now. And also always it has been our minds changing the community, outreach, education, involved in all the community events and works. You know, that's definitely in our mind.
Yeah. Go ahead, Stu.
I don't think we're really going anywhere. We're not really necessarily going anywhere. I think we like the idea of being in this area, and it's always been our goal to be here. I mean, there's so many people here, and it's an area where it should be this like mecca, this agricultural breadbasket. There should be a lot of surplus of product and sharing, and we have an amazing community. It's just we've kind of lost track of the things that a community needs, which is healthy spaces, delicious food. Just everything we need. So it's like we want to stay here and grow and make this the best that we possibly can.
Sure, you're changing a small corner of that. How big can that change get, do you think? How much influence do you think you can have over the community and where they get their food and creating those healthy spaces?
The coolest thing about the way that the world is connected today is that we have an influence that is very, very vast. It's a global influence. There are so many people that are following us and paying attention to what it is that we are doing. Locally, it's been a little challenging in the beginning, but we are slowly building our reputation, and the restaurants and the community support has been growing, since we came here. So I think that it's to be determined, but I don't see us slowing down anytime soon.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We're live in downtown Bloomington talking with the founder owners of Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group. Let's go to our audience. Can you state your name and share your question with us?
I'm Rich Beal, a member of the GLT Council, Friends Council. In talking with Colleen, you talked about education and you also spoke about that. Talking about working with local farmers already and educating, how much of a response have you had to that, or is that just in the beginning stages, and what interest are you finding from local farmers?
It's definitely not in the beginning stages. I can remember the very first season at the farm, really, maybe only having 6 months worth of farming experience, leading tours of 25 people through the garden and saying, hey, this is the future of food and the future of cuisine, and you need to taste this personally and eat this lamb's quarter because it's the healthiest thing you can enjoy, and it's such a regenerative, sustainable type of food. And so we've been doing that, and we have weekly outreaches. We train hundreds of employees employees a year. There's a vast amount of that. I regularly do speaking engagements. I probably do about 15 to 20 a year where I'm engaging audiences and groups and educational sectors or different, whether it's a hospital, a school, a high school, or even a college. Just got done with one in Chicago at Kendall College, as well as this Kale School Business with Kellogg and Kendall. But so that's like, that's definitely a big focus of it. In the recent years, we've actually, I think, had to withdraw from a lot of it because the facility wasn't there. So you drop off a school bus of 40 children, and you need to have facilities. You need to have handicap accessibility parking. You need to have, you know, the restrooms, a place for them to wash their hands. There's a lot of things that you have to have. So recently, we've actually withdrawn a touch from that. The new farm property is not open to the public, and that's simply so that we can build a facility that can facilitate that, and so that we can actually have hundreds of people coming through on a daily basis, becoming educated.
Do these buses full of children know where their food comes from?
Well, no, I don't know. Like, I don't think they do right now. I think obviously, the reality of our food system is that we are extremely disconnected, and that's the point of the food system. And so we're really going against, you know, a capitalistic approach towards raising food for an area or a group of people.
We'll go back to the audience in just a moment. Just a quick question. You were talking about some of the improvements you're doing at the farm. What all do you envision happening? You have two farms. Will they both be open to the public? And what do you envision happening at those farms? Let's go to Stu for that question.
As we continue to grow, think about whenever you're in the shoes of a business like ours, it's a lifestyle. We live it. I don't feel that we work on a day-to-day basis. This is how we function in every interaction. It doesn't have to be a setting where people are dropped off the farm, or that has to be in a place like this where there's the audience with a panel. Everyday conversations that we have with people, we have the opportunity to educate. There's 2,000 guests on a weekly basis that come into the restaurant, people that come to the farm. It's just us being transparent about how we feel systems need to be and educating people on a day-to-day basis through every interaction and conversation.
Let's go back to the audience. Another question. Tell us your name and share your question with us.
Hi, I'm Mercy Davison. Bill and I farmed locally a few years ago, and our last year at the farmers market, I believe, was your first year. Mm-hmm. And we were completely confused as to how you were planning to do all this. And I'm so happy that any doubt was completely unfounded. Congratulations. My question is for Nanam. I had two small children when we were on the farm, and you're working on number three yourself here. You'll have three kids under the age of four, maybe. Would you like to talk about what the lifestyle is like for a mom on a farm with full-time spouse and good friends that are all surrounding you?
Yeah, sure. It is very, very amazing. I want to start with that. I grew up in city, so I didn't have an access to all these farming things. And at the beginning when I started this, I was struggling, weeding, feeding pigs, digging out things, you know. It was just so difficult. But after a couple of years, and now having my own children, two and three coming soon, it becomes really their life. We just go out. If we want to have breakfast, we go out, pick eggs from chicken coops. When we cook for dinner, we go out, pick tomatoes. And my children learn how to distinguish colors by what's ripened. Yellow tomatoes, the only thing you can pick, or red tomatoes, don't touch greens. So they know the colors. It is really, really amazing that they become so calm, acceptable, and enjoying those outdoors. I hear a lot from other parents that my kids are very calm, and they don't go crazy. And also, I avoid lots of like chemicals, other foods, you know, because we get our food from our garden. So I see a lot of differences, and that's why I was talking to Kenneth about educational part too. Now I'm having my own children, I want to make this opportunity available for many other kids around the town, like the eating healthy food and also learning what's available out there and how to really human beings supposed to live. I think it's really important.
So you say you practice beyond organic farming techniques. Can you just Ken or Stu, tell me, what does beyond organic mean?
Yeah, I think we probably shouldn't say beyond organic, or at least print that. But
it is on your website.
Yeah, it is. I guess it means that, you know, we don't.
Are you carrying it a step further than what most people would think is organic?
No, I think I'm just refusing to pay a third party to come in and tell me that what I'm doing is correct. I think that there's a lot of monocultural production done organically or non-organically. The original salad greens in the supermarket when we first started having bagged lettuces were all produced organically. And yet when we created the organic status, they, like, part of their production they would label organic, the other part they would not, and they just made more money off the organic. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think that's why we have more of a transparent model. But the focus is about being regenerative, building soil, building an ecosystem.
We're talking about permaculture now.
Yes, absolutely. So I was very lucky to receive the permaculture design manual by Bill Molson and David Holmgreen my first year of farming. And this is now my seventh growing season, so I haven't really been farming for very long. But in the very beginning years, I started to look at these different types of agricultural models. Before, I thought that all we could grow in this county was corn, soybeans, and alfalfa. And very, very luckily for me, I was at the farmer's market, and it was 2004, and I met a farmer, and I was stopping here from being in New York for culinary school. I was getting ready to go to business school in Las Vegas, and I saw all these things he had available to stand. I was like, this is all grown in our town? He's like, yeah, I live right by you. I'm like, get out of here. I was like, can I come to your farm? And we went, and I was blown away. I was like, my first peaches, my first cherries, my first everything I had for the first time. And here I was, you know, I spent the summer there. I went there probably 5 or 6 times, and then I had to leave because I was going to business school. I'm like, I'm leaving for 5 years at least. But the entire time I knew that this area was being underserved when it came to the variety of fruits and vegetables and meats being produced on its county soils.
So permaculture in a nutshell is what?
Permaculture is just this idea of looking at natural systems and designing our agricultural systems in using nature's principles. And so it's a permanent agriculture, meaning that you focus on not tilling the soil and creating an ecosystem that produces food for not only ourselves but also the ecosystem itself, so that it becomes regenerative and actually much more sustainable. So sustainability is a benchmark, and when you spend an entire century destroying your ecosystems, sustainable systems don't really work. We need regenerative systems, and so that's the idea. So sustainability, if me and Anam's relationship was just sustainable, it'd be pretty poor. And so it's like...
it needs to be beyond sustainable.
Yeah. So I think that's what we're saying, right. But I might have to adjust that.
So I'm jumping back to your website again. Hopefully this is accurate as well. You're trying to blend the farms and the restaurants to create what your website calls one self-sustaining organism. Stu, what does that mean, and are you reaching it?
It's connecting the dots. It's the full circle of harvest to distribution. What comes in the back door gets fabricated at the restaurant, things that we produce, and being connected, knowing where the food comes from, and having our staff educated so they can continue to pass that on to our consumer, our guests, in all facets of our business. It's a daily struggle, and it's like when we took on Station 220 as consultants, it was a huge endeavor. It's like it was a beast of a restaurant with 2 floors and banquets that were rocking, and we had to scale up really quickly. And you know, you'd get a little better every day, and now we're over 5 years of operation, and I think that feels to me like we're on a launch pad now. It's like we figured some systems out, and we're ready to take the next steps.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We're live in downtown Bloomington. Coming up, we'll hear from ISU Politics and Government Professor Eric Rankin and Tricia Stiller with the Downtown Bloomington Association. We're also talking with Stu Hummel, Nanam Mishka, and Ken Mishka with Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group. And they're opening a new restaurant in Leroy, and we're in one of their newest locations, Epiphany on Main. How does what you're growing and how it's performing affect the menu? Ken, when we were here not too long ago, we walked around, it was a week or two ago, and you just harvested eggplant, and you had like 650 pounds of it in the walk-in refrigerator. How does that affect the menu? or what you want to do with that, and how does it show up on a plate, either at Epiphany Farms or at Anjou Above?
Yeah, it's so in the beginning, we would chefs look for inspiration in ways of either looking through respected cookbooks or studying food trends or getting a hint from a purveyor that things are becoming very cheap because there's a bumper crop of them, and then you start designing the menu and the recipes. And the way that we do it is that we start in the beginning of the season. We usually like to place our seed order before January 1st. We design and build the entire growing calendar for the year. We place the seed order, which is, you know, thousands of dollars worth of seed. And then we have a hypothetical idea of what the menu is going to be. And then what happens is all of the fun things that go on in a growing season, whether it's trays getting mixed up in the greenhouse or seeds not germinating or, you know, the plastic getting ripped off through a heavy storm, or like
this was a good year for eggplant, though, right?
Yeah, so eggplant specifically.
I mean, there's a lot of eggplant back there.
So it's a perfect example. So last year we lost 50% of our eggplant because we had a flood on one of our sites. This year we didn't lose any of our eggplant, but we also scaled up a lot. And then I went to a few other local farms and I was like, hey, how's your eggplant producing? And they're like, it is gangbusters. Like, what is going on? So right now eggplant's just like super happy, but no one wants to eat eggplant.
So that's my next question. Stu, make me like eggplant. What are you going to do with it?
You got to hide it in something that everybody likes.
Well, then why grow it?
It's all disguise.
No, seriously, though. Is that what you really do?
Yeah, the tomato ragu.
I mean, it does take on the flavor of what it's with, to a
eggplant,
certain degree.
It's like
amazing.
You want to take a piece of eggplant, throw it in deep fryer, fry it up, toss it in cinnamon.
Deep fry anything and I'll eat that.
Exactly. Toss it in cinnamon and sugar and you've got vegetarian donuts. They're amazing. They're awesome. But the idea is that we also produce eggplant specifically for Eataly in Chicago.
I was going to say, some of this eggplant doesn't end up in your restaurants.
And we grow 14 varieties of eggplant. You know, we grow, you know, 36 varieties of tomatoes. There's, you know, all in all, 250 varieties of annual crops and at least 250 varieties of perennial crops. But you just don't know what's going to happen each year. But the cool thing is, instead of us having this menu that we have to stick to, we can adjust it. So we rewrite the menus every 2 weeks. And we don't change the menu and start over, but what we do is we adjust. And so we're kind of like observing nature, observing the agricultural system, and then adjusting that. And we have complete control of that supply chain. And so that's an advantage that other restaurants don't have.
Nanam, do customers come in expecting to find something on the menu, and then you've rewritten it, and their favorite thing isn't on the menu? Do you hear that sort of thing with either of your restaurants?
Because we're changing.
Because you're changing the menus.
We are trying to keep some signature items. We keep an eye on like our Yelp reviews, our website, phone calls, and talk with the guests every single night. So we're trying to keep those things that are popular, but also trying to add those freshness. Like, same thing going back to the education, same thing with eggplant. Even though people don't like it, maybe they don't know how good it tastes. So we're trying to put those things in and enlightening their palates.
I'm never going to find a tomato in any shape or form on the menu in the off season, am I?
No, we don't. Yeah. Well, we have just the aromas that we preserve those for the sauce on the pizza at Rustic or Anjou Pizzeria or Anjou Above.
Is there a way to break down the percentages? How much of the food on any given entree is something that you've grown or raised? Is there a way to do that? Do you have a rough estimate?
We have dishes that are so farm forward, less the salt or maybe a little seasoning of olive oil on the plate. It's 99.9% right off the farm. And it's like, especially this time of year.
Well, what's an example of that? What's on the menu right now?
Our chicken that we raise on the farm. Pork feature on a daily basis that's all farm forward. And that's a loose menu descriptor. For instance, like Fresh Farm Vegetables or Epiphany Farms Harvest. And that's what's coming in the back door that day. And that's most likely going to have eggplant on it.
we've been warned.
And everyone asks, like, well, what do you do in the winter and how much? And so there's a lot of goods. Like, the cost of goods, when you look at the books, there's you know, almost $1 million of purchased product on the cost of goods. That includes a lot of things that go towards making food that you cannot produce locally. But last year, you know, $250,000 came from our farm. And so that would be technically 25% of the food purchase was bought. We could probably get it to 55, 60%. But we're also trying to grow fast, and we have other restaurants. And when we opened up Anju, we actually saw the percentage of cost, the percentage of goods come down because we quickly scaled up. And then the farm can't react to that as fast. And so we're getting better at that. So when I was, you know, for instance, I delegated my responsibilities at the restaurant in December, end of December, January, and we knew what we were doing this year. We had a plan. In February, we started planting. I went 6 months hard on the farm to increase production so we could open up another restaurant. And so we're not just waiting. It's like we're actively thinking. So we're trying to get to a point where we're planning the company's goals and what we're going to do a year out.
And your farms are going to not only supply Epiphany Farms Restaurant and Anju Above and the Old Bank Restaurant and Bar in Leroy, which we'll talk about in a moment, you're still able to also ship some of this. You have surplus that you're sending to other restaurants or markets.
Yeah, during the growing season, we have a surplus of certain crops like eggplant or tomatoes, zucchini. But then also, since we're chefs that are farming, we know exactly the specific things that the chefs want in Chicago. So we have a very, very high demand for our specialty produce in Chicago, where we specialize in like medicinal crops, blossoms, fruits, edible forage, you know, blooms, and like all these crazy things. Mushrooms, like for instance, yesterday we had another big chanterelle harvest. We've already harvested, you know, a couple hundred pounds of wild chanterelles. Like, there's a wild market for wild ramps. We do a lot of like things like that that we have an eye for, and that are actually more valuable in the Chicago market than they are in our own restaurant. And as time goes on, I think that this area will come to a point where they realize that, you know, wild ramps and stinging nettles are something I should order. But right now, it's kind of like us trying to push the community in that direction, and then also the community kind of saying, oh, hey, we're not ready for that. And so it's kind of like a push and pull with the area here. But in Chicago, we have a very high demand, and we produce on contract for Eataly, and then also some Boca Group restaurants like Bolina and Boca and such.
Let's go to the audience. We have another question.
Hi.
Go ahead and state your name and give us your question.
Julie Kupsch. And first, I want to commend you guys for breathing life into this again. Cool.
Thank you.
And by this you mean, by this you mean 513 North Main, the former Lancaster space.
Yeah, I'm just believing in downtown and keeping so much down here. And I think I go back, like Mercy, about 6 years ago, our daughter did work and live in downtown and then went to grad school. But when she was in St. Louis, she called me and she asked me to come get pork bellies from you. And you came out. It was snowing. I'm from Wisconsin. I'm in my little Volkswagen driving to who knows where. And then I see this driveway that's drifted. And I'm like, I can do this. And out you come with the pork bellies. And I take them to St. Louis. I'm like, what the heck are these people doing? But it was awesome. And so then tell us about Korean barbecue dreams, because we go to New York for a trade show every spring, and last 2 years, Korean barbecue.
So yeah, so Korean barbecue is awesome. Korean barbecue is one of the restaurants you sort of have in mind in the future. Nanam, you want to take that question?
Sure.
Well, Korean barbecue is what we're envisioning is something that you cook on your table, so people gather. That's like kind of our culture. As soon as you sit down, within 2 minutes, all the we call banchan, small dishes coming out, and then someone will bring a meat, and then you will cook on the table, and everybody gathers and just eat and enjoy. And when Ken was traveling, and I forced Stu to go with us as
you
well.
Asked me.
and we all enjoy the culture, food, and it's so much connected to kind of the steak feeling that lots of people in here, this area, enjoys. So that's why we were kind of thinking about these ideas and bringing those cultural, some diverse to the town.
Yeah,
so that's why.
I've been in it like every Korean barbecue in Seoul, New York, Chicago, like you name it, like I'm all over it. And like I look at it, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the perfect concept. They don't tell you what they're going to give you. You just sit down and in 2 minutes you have 20 plates in front of you. All these different like vegetarian dishes, meat dishes, small appetizers. It's like a salad bar brought to your table. And I'm like, they don't tell you what this is and they give you free refills of everything. I'm like, that's perfect for the farm. Like, we could just, you know, eggplant.
A market for surplus eggplant.
Right. And then you order the protein and it's this really fun interactive experience, and you order, and you order like, you know, 8 ounces, and you cook it in a fashion that's so flavorful and so delicious and so fun that you split it and you're full. You enjoy it. And at the end of the meal, you ate a quarter of the amount of protein that you would have eaten if you would have went to a restaurant and ordered a steak. And so the style of dining and the execution of it, as well as the energy and the vibe and the feel of it, are something that this community needs. And that's something that we want to do. And so
you'll be opening that tomorrow for us,
yeah, right?
So we know your business plan, your model, your effort to create one organism by blending farm and restaurant. And we know that's important to you. Is it important to customers, Stu?
Absolutely.
Do they care?
Yeah, after you educate them and invite them to the farm, show them our process, show them how labor intensive it is, and it's just being transparent about it. I think people, they start to care.
Do they care as much as you want them to care?
They can care as much or as little as they want to. Yeah.
So what would the restaurant be like if you weren't drawing ingredients from these two farms? Would you be doing restaurants?
Absolutely. But I mean, before I knew that a potato plant actually came out of the ground and you didn't just have to sit behind a computer and put an order in and have it delivered to the back door. I mean, that's how chefs envision restaurants. It's like they just are ignorant, and like our whole culture is ignorant to the actual growing side and the agrarian side of it. It's very important. It would have way less flavor. What we get from the farm is so nutritionally dense and flavorful. It's uncomparable.
I don't think that the community or the guest care as much as we want them to care.
But they do care about what their food is like, what their food tastes like, and the quality of it.
They care about the experience. They care about the satisfaction. They care about eating. They care about having a good space, the right temperature, the right climate, the right energy. They care about that. And I would be honest with you, I think that we focus on disguising the fact that we are as connected and as sustainable as we are.
You think you ought to be promoting that more?
I don't know, because we don't want it to be in their face. We don't want it to come off as being pretentious or like being too much.
So disguising it's not negative? Not a negative thing?
Not necessarily, because sometimes these type of restaurants get a really negative connotation. And it's important for us to make sure that they feel like this is just like a neighborhood restaurant that they can enjoy on a daily basis. And it's really hurt us to think that this is something that's special.
You don't want people to think it's hoity-toity.
Right. And that's we've been dealing with that since the beginning. And I think in the sound bit earlier, it was like we've been focusing on bringing the check average and price down. And that's still something we want to do, because the goal is to feed more people. And you can't feed more people if it's too expensive.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, you'll hear from Tricia Stiller, the executive director of the Downtown Bloomington Association. We'll get her reaction to the Epiphany Farms downtown expansion. And right now we'll turn to Eric Rankin. He's an Illinois State University political scientist. He teaches a course on politics and food. Eric, what are you hearing in our conversation? Anything you'd like to comment on? And do you think most people care about where their food comes from?
No. And the only reason I say that is because of I think that students, and this is in my area, right? So students generally, they think little about what they put into their mouth. And we've talked about this. There's a great book that we read in class called Mindless Eating. The act of eating is an intimate act in the first place, right? Of taking food into your mouth. I said, do you consider when you put other things into your mouth? And students immediately are like, yeah. I said, so why is it when it comes time to food that we're so disconnected from what it is that we eat? This class that I started a few years ago, I think most people in your listening audience and us that are here can understand that you can only talk about politics so long before most people get a little tired. And that includes the professors who get a little bit tired about talking about presidential elections. So I tried to reconceptualize something that was important to me. I've been in the health and wellness and fitness area for a really long time. And the connection that I found was that the ignorance that I heard just a minute ago is rampant with my students. They just didn't know. I mean, even you saw the story that came out about 6 months ago that Portillo's was going to come to Bloomington Normal, and you would swear that Jesus Christ himself had just landed in Bloomington Normal. I mean, it was, Portillo's! And to see that they are so drawn into this industrialized, eating machine that they've grown up around, and it's not necessarily their fault. We have not done a good job. at educating our students. And that's honestly because their parents were never educated either. So they grew up in this faster is better, and they believe that faster is cheaper too. So part of what we've attempted to do in this class is to talk to them about hidden cost of what they don't see. You know, a fifth of all of our fossil fuel is being spent just to feed ourselves. And students, the moment that they step back and take a look at some of those facts, it's hard to put that type of stuff back in the box. And you know, I get this comment all the time of, well, you can't fix stupid. And I said, well, that's kind of my job as a professor, is to try and change this, right? And I've taken students out to the Rob Jersey Cheese Farm to let them be involved in the process and see what it looks like. You know, they eat the cheese, and I said, does it taste any different? And you just see their face, they're like, this is completely different.
So is there a cost? We're talking about millennials.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a cost barrier to finding good food? Because eating poorly is generally cheaper.
Right. So again, here's the, and we talk about it, it is cheaper on the front side. But the cost on the backside, right? I can give you now, after being at Illinois State University, starting my 17th academic year, I shaved my hair to hide the gray. The students that used to run up to the fourth floor of Schrader Hall didn't used to bend over at my desk when they get there going, and I go, man, when you're 40, you're going to be in trouble, right? This is an 18-year-old that has been, you know, saddled with a lifetime of Portillo's and McDonald's and these things, and they think that those things are cheap, but they're not cheap, because down the road, you're going to be, right, one of the stories that I use in class, and I think this is, in 1963, Disney built a ride. If you've been to Disney, I guarantee you every parent has sat on It's a Small World. And the irony of this ride is amazing. In 2007, they had to dig up the moat and dig it deeper, because in 1963, the average male was 175 pounds, the average female was 135 pounds. They were finding by 2007 that if you put the normal 16 people in a boat, the boat was bottoming out and could no longer move forward. So there's your hidden costs, right? We've now got to this point where we have a society that, you know, an obesity epidemic, it is a real thing, and those costs are serious. And if we don't do something to combat this, and this is where, you know, great restaurants like this, it is, you can still eat yourself silly if you want to, but the nutritionally dense idea, it's a totally different concept that really changes, you know, some of the concepts of their relationship with food. And it's not the student's fault, it's the fault of just the system that really doesn't talk to them about good choices.
Let's jump to the audience. We have another question. State your name and give us your question, please.
Hi, I'm Adrienne Powell. I have traveled this road with you guys since you came to town, and was lucky enough to go to a couple of the dinner parties. And to not take it off your topic, I want to talk about your team, because your team has a reputation of working really, really hard, but also having a family atmosphere. My daughter was part of your team for a while and talked about the family dinner. And I just wanted to know, how do you motivate your team to work so hard, but still they seem like they're having a great time?
I think that's the key right there, is the team. You know, the company invests more in the team than it does in food, way more. And so it makes a lot of sense for us to invest in our culture. When we took over the restaurant 5 years ago, the only thing we did is change the culture at first. We didn't really have to change the restaurant much. But it was about, you know, the employees caring about each other and caring as teaching each other and treating each other with respect. And so we have like some really basic rules that we follow. You got to, you know, say hello and goodbye to people when you leave and come. You have to give seriously good high fives. You're not allowed to fake smile. You're not allowed to do these things that you would just be like, well, what do you mean you can't do those? It's like, no, these are like, so we focus, I think, on the basics. And when Charlie Schlenker had interviewed me one time about our team, he asked me, what skills do you need to succeed on our team? I described all the skills, and he said, well, those sound like human skills. And I'm like, well, yeah, they are. Like, they're just, that's it. It's like, we care about each other.
How big a challenge is it to find talent and retain talent?
That's a big challenge.
Stu?
One out of four?
One out of
four. That sounds about right.
Yeah, Yeah, we've done a lot when it comes to trying to inspire employees to come and work for us and make sure that we take care of them, especially when you're an independent company that doesn't have like a lot of the perks of other businesses. We do what we can. So, you know, we eat together every day at 3 o'clock. We have a family meal. We have a daily meeting. We have a company meeting once a month where we go very transparent about everything and we work together. What are some of the other things we do?
One of the three of us is always present through the hiring process, and I think that's really important as far as us building our team. And the qualities that we look for in people aren't so much what's written on paper. It's a one-on-one look in the eye whenever you're standing across from the table, and you can kind of identify with somebody, and if you can relate with them and you have a connection, it's like, I think this person would work well on our team. And it's all about the people we surround ourselves with. We can maintain culture through a lot of high fives and a lot of positive energy. And those are the first two rules that we explain to everyone. It's like, you have to come in with a good attitude. If you don't, then go home. And it's like identified right away. And it's contagious as one way or the other. Bad attitudes are contagious, so are good attitudes.
Let's bring in Tricia Stiller. She's the executive director of the Downtown Bloomington Association. What's your reaction to the success and expansion of Epiphany Farms in the downtown area?
Well, I am just so enthusiastic about the continued growth that is on your horizon. You guys have already done so much, but much like others have already mentioned, when you first began and started sharing your dreams, it was like, that's a nice dream, guys. I'm really encouraged by your tenacity, for one, your organization, the camaraderie. It's a wonderful illustration with how you can get things done. If you believe first, everything else will fall into place. And I think that's a wonderful example that you're setting for all of us.
We're setting in the Epiphany Hospitalities Group, third location in downtown Bloomington.
Correct.
Why do you think this group and downtown are a good match?
Well, they kind of embody all that makes a downtown thrive. They're independent, they're strong, they have a dream, they understand their own value, which is really, really important. I think sometimes downtowners forget how wonderful we are as a community, as the heart of this city. We sometimes lose track of that because we're all at work and we're staring at our monitors and so on. So it's nice to have this shining beacon to constantly look to and say, you know, you're one of those continually growing overnight sensations. You know, it's like, oh, look at them. And you know, they were just recognized by the Illinois Department of Tourism as an Illinois Maker. And we're so thrilled to have that. It's the second time Corey Job has visited your establishment here in the city. And I anticipate that he's going to be a regular visitor to our community.
Quickly, we're running out of time. The Old Bank Bar and Restaurant in Leroy opens on
Thursday.
And tell me about one menu item that everybody should get.
Oh my gosh. The title is...
You have 20 seconds.
Smart investments. Have a salad bar. All you can eat fresh, but delicious local food. $4.95.
Okay. Ken Mishka, Nanam Mishka, Stu Hummel are co-owners, founders of Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group. Their newest restaurant is opening in Leroy on Thursday. Also, thanks to Eric Rankin, ISU Politics and Government Professor and Executive Director of the Downtown Bloomington Association, Tricia Stiller. Today's episode was also possible thanks to GLT's Travis Metters, Mark Hill, Linda Healy, and Willis Kern. Find this and other Sound Ideas episodes online at WGLT.org. That's also where you can get in touch to let us know what you think of this show. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.